Coach, sorry, I was going to ask that before you go through, because this is a really interesting one that I'm sure a lot of coaches are wondering. How do you help your athletes through those two different types of energy, the defensive energy and that offensive state of relaxation? Is there something specific you're doing in that conversation? How does that take place?
I think for one thing, you can help your players on the offensive end by teaching them to change speeds. You know, I think one of the things you learn about watching the best shooters in the NBA, you know, whether it's Ray Allen or you know, Reggie Miller, guys like that, is that they have learned to slow down and then speed up. And they practice it that way. I think that one of the things that happens to kids is that they go out in the game and the game speeds up for them. That's why I'm such a big believer in shooting in drills at game speed, coming off of picks at game speed, having a coach or somebody, a manager, putting a hand up on almost every shot. Because I think that what happens is a lot of kids do a ton of shooting drills, but they don't do it the same way that they're going to do in a game, and it just feels so uncomfortable. I think the second thing is, obviously, repetition over and over and over of the same thing tends to bring some relaxation. I think the third part of it is, you know, kids shooting shots in games and allowing them to shoot shots in games that they shoot all the time. The worst thing is that I'm pretty tolerant as a coach for shooters, but it's got to be something that they've practiced. You know, don't come and do a teardrop in the middle of the lane if that's not something you practice. You know, that might be something you have to do in the last 2 seconds of a game out of necessity, but the kid that all of a sudden he's going to do a finger roll or a teardrop or whatever, that's something that's an everyday practice. And I tell all of our players, I'll tolerate any shot that I know you've practiced every day and I see you make at game speed. It's just a huge thing. And I think that the repetition of doing that allows somebody to do that. I had a long talk with Coach Paul Westhead, who now is out at the University of Oregon, but all of you know him for his fast break stuff. And he used to have his players, when they were young, say yes every time they shot the ball to replicate the idea of swish. And it tended to relax the last part of their shot. I've tried it with some kids. Some kids it works, some kids it doesn't. But it tended to slow them down. But I think the last part of it is just, you know, as a shooter, I always want to know the coach had confidence in me in taking shots, that it was okay for me to take the shot because he knew I had practiced them. Now, the other part of it, I said, you know, about practicing shots, we actually have players practice off-balance shots in the lane, creative shots, learning to use the glass, those sorts of things, 1 foot off the wrong foot. So that it's not a new thing when all of a sudden they get put in a situation in the game where they get bumped and there's no call. I think that tends to add to relaxation. It's not something they're afraid of doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. In the same vein, if I just wanted to go back to something else you'd said earlier. You'd mentioned dealing with the psyche of your best players and wanted to ask you to speak to that. You know, a lot of coaches find themselves with, you know, one or maybe two, if they're fortunate, dominant players. But how do you develop the psyche of your best players? And then the flip side to that is, what, if anything, do you do or have you done to develop the psyche of the players that are role players or support the supporting cast?
Well, I think the first thing goes is I don't think your best players are really your best players unless they're your best workers. So I think the first thing you need for the psyche of your team and for them is that they have to take ownership of everything that goes on in your program. If your best players aren't your best workers, I don't know how far you can go. So I constantly challenge my best players to have a say in what we do, but it also they have to understand that with that say comes accountability. You know, I think you know, responsibility and accountability are things that have gotten away from a lot of players. And I think if you do that early on, you set a tone for your team. They sooner or later understand the undertaking and understand the responsibility they have. So I think that's the first thing. You know, sometimes it'll be, I already know the decision I'd like to make for my team, but I'll have my best players or my captains, who usually are amongst our best players, in on a decision, and I can kind of direct them or talk them to, you know, the decision I'd like them to make, and hope that they do, because, you know, I think it benefits everybody, and let them feel like they had a huge part of it. And sometimes they're going to have more of an idea of what should be done than you will as a coach. They see the tone in the locker room. They see those things. So my thing is, you have to hold them accountable. I also tell them that I'm going to be harder on them probably than that role player some days, because if they want that stardom that goes with being the better player, then they have to understand that I'm going to push them maybe harder than anybody else. The person that's killing themselves to make a team and be a role player probably has a pretty good work ethic to start out with. If they don't, you probably don't want them on your team anyway. There's nothing worse than a bad attitude role player. So
yeah,
I think that's the starting point. For the role players, I found a real difference, and if I offend anybody in this, I'm sorry, but there's a real difference with role players in men's basketball and women's basketball, and I've seen it differently. I think that, unfortunately, in the women's game, we've had players grow into being role players who are very, very skilled, and they get labeled or put in a niche somewhere along the way, and what happens is that they get comfortable with that and don't try to expand their game, or they don't want to be out of that comfort zone. And I think it's very different, whereas you have guys who think that they're role player, but you know what, coach, if you made me the star, I'd be just as good at that. and I'm sure there's some people nodding their heads, because it's one of those things that, you know, I think in the women's game, there's a great need by players to have your team be a family and everybody get along. But I think at times there's a little bit of negativeness in that people get maybe too comfortable in being a role player. And, you know, I would like to think that, at least at my level, that any one of our players has been a star in college, that at a given time they are skilled enough to, you know, undertake being more of a factor on offense or more of a producer than maybe they are every night. But I think, you know, roles to me are, you know, doing what you need for your team to win that night. And there are nights that somebody else has to step up more, and there are nights the star who's not having a great night has to understand that they got to do something else. But I think it all starts with accountability.
Fantastic. Coach, I know one of your favorite quotes is that insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Yes, it is.
That one is Albert Einstein. How do you take that thought and translate it over to, you know, coaching?
Well, I think there's a couple things. Number one, we get into comfort zones as a coach because something worked well for us for a period of time, however long that period is. You know, you have a team that's done well for a couple of years, and you get comfortable with that. And you are slow to realize or change when you don't have maybe the same personnel, the same skill sets. You know, things have changed. I think that that's a stubbornness. If you don't change, that becomes insanity. It's back to what I said at the start about evaluating yourself. If you're doing the same drills every day, and you're still let's say you're doing the same fast break drills every day and you're still not converting or finishing on the end of a break, or you're missing the layups, or you're turning it over, then you need to sit down and reevaluate, is there a different or better way to do this? You know, I think that, you know, I hear coaches say, well, I told my players we need to do this. Well, that's great. You know, I can tell my daughter I want her to clean her room too. But unless there's another way to get her to do it, I better rethink it. You know, I think that you have to, you know, if you're missing layups as a team, you know, I hate turnovers and layups. Well, I can keep hating them, but if I don't do anything to change how we convert them, or maybe there's, you know, more drills or different drills we need to do to learn to finish better, or a different way to shoot going to the basket, you know, I think you guys point that out in your summer stuff about, you know, kids who come to the 2 foot stop versus the 1 foot layup in certain situations. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're doing it the same way every time and you're doing it and you're having problems, then it's time to reevaluate and change. I think that's the biggest thing. I don't know. I think you can apply it to almost everything you do. Do you know if you're talking about scouting reports and your kids aren't getting it, or you're drawing up plays at timeouts and they're not getting it, maybe you need to reevaluate how you're teaching or how you're doing it. More and more as I've coached, I've learned that, you know, every kid learns differently. And, you know, some people are visual learners, some are, you know, walk through it learners, some, you know, we have the video game generation. We've gone to putting our playbook on a DVD for our players, because they actually watch that and get it better with diagrams on the video than they do on a written diagram that you give them. I think that's a huge thing. I had a coach tell me one time, geez, I can't get my kids to understand what we're doing on coming out of timeouts. They line up in the wrong spot. And I said, well, how do you hold the board at a timeout? And he kind of looked at me, and I said, well, when you're facing your team at a timeout, do you hold the board when you draw it in the same direction that it is actually on the court? And he said, no. I said, well, maybe that's why your kids are not looking at the court the same way you are. I used to give out, you know, scouting reports, and one day I decided to have our players draw up our five best plays or favorite plays, gave them the name of the plays, and gave them basketball diagrams to draw it up. And I got every version you could possibly think of the same play, even though I had drawn it up on the board and given them a playbook all year. When they came back, well, the post players were looking out from the baseline and the guards were looking in from the top. And if you don't know how your kids see that, then I think you're being stubborn. So that all goes into that heading of learning how people learn.
And so coming out of that, I had a conversation with your longtime assistant coach, Coach Hawk, about this very thing. And I know you're big on learning to say things in different ways.
Yep.
Do you speak to your posts differently than your guards, if you're talking about, you know, we're going to line up on the right side or the left side? What vocabulary have you developed around that, or how do you deal with the different ways people learn or process information?
Well, from that standpoint, we've kept that fairly consistent because I've told them that, you know, however you look at it, you know, I look at the game when I'm coaching looking in from the top. I see it like a point guard. I see it as a guard. And that the right block is, you know, how I'm facing the basket, those things. And that's what we're going to have to do as a group, because I'm not going to try to remember every time I'm at a timeout, you know, how we're going to get that across to you. But I do tell them what our vocabulary is. I'll give you a thing that we went to that I learned from George Carl years ago, that has really simplified things for us, for example, on the defensive end. You know, we all talk about talking on defense and helping on pick and rolls and calling screens, you know, screen right, screen left, you know, switch, show, and it gets very confusing and heated in the time of game. And what we did is simplify all of our pick and roll coverages into numbers. So, for example, if we are going to have a hard hedge on a pick and roll, that would be a 2 for us. If we're going to switch, it would be a 1. If we were going to go through, we would have another call. And it made it very simple for our team. And for years, I had gone through, you know, God, they don't know whether it's coming right or left. And it's, you know, even if they yell it, they're trying to communicate who's going to switch. And then you're letting the defense know what you're going to do. We just put it into simple numbers. So that was one of the things we did. When we're in shell defense, you know, everybody has different terminology for, you know, weak side help and, you know, ball side pressure and everything else, and borrowing from other people, we've tried to simplify it. We try to put our weak side in an eye. People can understand that there's the top of the eye, the middle of the eye, and the bottom of the eye in the middle of the lane. And the ball's maybe on the left wing. Well, we're in an eye, you know, in the middle of the lane on help. And the deepest person just yells deep so that they know that they have help there. That was a concept that we kind of developed, that Coach came up with, that was a simple concept and yelling deep to know where everybody was, and everybody knew who had that spot on the floor. It doesn't really matter what it is as long as everybody on your team understands the concept and they all can react to it the same. It's just hard when you have, you know, and particularly in our league, we have players coming from, you know, 9 or 10 different college backgrounds, and to try to get them all with the same terminology on the same page is really important. So we've tried to simplify as many of those things as we can. Sometimes when you're teaching kids, if you're not getting through, I go back to elementary school teachers who will tell you, try to find the simplest visual picture that a kid will see when you say something, and that may be the way they're going to learn it. There's probably 100 examples, but those are just things, you know, some people when they get up on defense on people, they'll say swarm, others say smother. Whatever it is, it's how your kids understand it and what they learn from it and that everybody's on the same page.
Mm-hmm. That helps, definitely. Coach, I did have one other question, and then after that we'll open it up. I know Lindsay's been messaging me, letting me know that there are a number of the coaches that are listening in who are submitting questions, so I'd encourage others by all means to do the same. If you're online, then fire away. Lindsay's capturing those questions. My last question before we open it up, you know, given all the games that are taking place right now during March Madness, you've got an extensive background scouting. You watch a lot of tape, and you spoke earlier about you know, coaches being able to learn from watching video. What do you watch for, or what would you suggest?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm watching a little differently from somebody else right now because I'm looking at specific players for our league. Mm-hmm. But in general, I try to tell people, particularly parts of the game that maybe you aren't comfortable with or don't know as much about, to watch it throughout the college tournament season and the NBA playoffs. More and more, I'll give an example. More and more, as we talked about the other day, the pick and roll is getting back into the game. We've gotten away from complete continuity offenses. You know, some people are playing with shot clocks, some are not. But there are probably 9 or 10 different ways to play defense against pick and rolls. And you can see all kinds. And I think a lot of times people get locked into a certain way to do it. Look and see how a lot of people do it. You know, the NBA, for whatever people think or don't think of the NBA, has a lot more possessions in the game to try to defend with a 24-second clock and an 8-second half court. And so they have, you know, 80 to 90 possessions a game. And probably now in the NBA you have to defend pick and roll on at least 50 or 60 of those possessions, and you'll see different ways of doing it. You know, see what fits your team. See, you know, what your point guards are going to see as an offensive player at pick and rolls. Try to see from their point of view with all the bodies in the lane and where their next decision has got to be. You know, if you're being trapped, what's my first read? What's my second read? Is there going to be somebody open on the other side of the floor? We try to tell our guards to watch this and understand that anytime people are trapping hard or showing hard on pick and rolls, at least for a couple seconds you're playing against a zone. And maybe zone offense principles apply at that point. You know, dribble penetration, draw and kick, those kinds of things. So watch the different ways. If you have a great shooter on your team and you're trying to figure out how to use that shooter, watch the different teams that do and figure out how they get them open. You know, watch the Celtics, how they get Ray Allen open. Watch the Lakers if you have a good post player and how they clear space for somebody like Pau Gasol or Bynum to get, or San Antonio with Duncan to give them room to operate on the block. The NBA, there's a lot of really smart coaches in that league, and they've spent a lot of hours, and their life depends on how well they do that. And so the things that they're trying and doing, even though they have some different defensive rules, they're very creative about what they do to get people open for shots or get people space to operate. And I think, you know, that's one of the big things. Even when we're starting training camp in May, I'm watching NBA playoff games every night and taking notes, trying to say, you know, we run a similar play. Why do they do this a little bit better? What can we tweak in ours?